From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When our own Kelsey Moore and Elaine Clark went to Huntsville, Utah this past summer to talk to the remaining monks at the Holy Trinity Monastery, there weren't that many left. There was a time, though, when the place was thriving. Father Patrick Boyle said when he first showed up, there were 84 monks, many of them part of that great rush of men who fought in World War II and were looking for solitude and healing after. You should have heard the choir in those days, he said. But at some point, the men stopped coming. Father Patrick said nobody stayed at the monastery in Huntsville for 30 years, and in August, it closed. Which is giving us an opportunity today to talk about the history of monastic life for men, but for women too. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few months ago, we produced a short film about the Trappist Monastery in Ogden Valley, the Abbey of Our Lady of the Holy Trinity. The story we wanted to tell is, what is it like to close down a place like that? The monastery thrived for decades. Some of you listening will remember the honey they produced and sold. In the film, Father Brendan Freeman said, what happens to a monastery is what can happen to a family when there are no children to continue on the name. And in recent years, it became clear that younger monks weren't going to come and replenish the place in Huntsville. In August, Holy Trinity closed. And it got us wondering, first, why they came, as they did in great numbers after World War II, but also why they stopped coming. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of the monastic life. Our guests on the program included Craig Harling. He's a professor of history at Brigham Young University. Michael Higgins is a distinguished professor of Catholic thought at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And Margaret McGinnis, who's a professor of religion at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. She studies Catholic sisters and nuns. I guess I wanted to begin broadly, and Craig Harling, since you're here in the studio with me, and I want to hear all of you on this, what is, in essence, and we'll break this down as we go, what is the appeal for a monastic life, I guess, at its most basic element?
If you look back at the very beginnings, you might say that, in part, it was a desire to leave the world as then constituted, and even a kind of quiet or implicit protest against the church as then constituted, and emerged in the 4th century, maybe even earlier than that. But that was the idea, to find God, and people weren't finding God within society or even in some cases within the church. So we often think of monasticism as an integral part of Catholicism especially, and yet, as I often tell my students, you can regard each new movement as a sort of quiet protest, in the sense that they're saying, the kind of spirituality I need doesn't now exist within the church, and I need to find it. And mostly it's me trying to find God.
Michael Higgins, what do you think to that question?
Well, the monastic life predates Christianity, actually, and the call to the individual monos, the one, is not, again, peculiar to the Christian stamp, but put within the context of the Christian framework, and monasticism has particularly flourished in the Christian world, most specifically the Catholic and Orthodox churches. The appeal, I think, in great measure, in part, is linked to the early romantic notion that monastic witness is a radical statement. It's a radical living out of the Gospels. It's a form of what we sometimes call white martyrdom. The martyrdom of confessors and witnesses that doesn't result in the kind of red martyrdom of the more literal martyrs, because it takes seriously the preparation for the other world. It's an eschatological witness. The monk lives in solitude or lives in community. There are anchorites and there are cenobites. But the monastic call is a call to radical witness. And the fact that there are, in some instances, like the monastery you alluded to in Utah that closed down, raises questions about the continued validity of monastic witness, But perhaps even more, the historical reality that monasticism has its own cycles. And we may be at a point in history where a new iteration of the monastic lifestyle is being called for.
Margaret McGuinness, I think there's some idea that the monks who came to the Trappist Monastery in Huntsville, Utah, came to heal themselves, many of them anyway, as a result of their experience in World War II. But you've said that that's not exactly what a monastery is about. It's not necessarily about healing yourself. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that, you know, there are right reasons and wrong reasons to enter a monastery. And I think that at least in the post-World War II years, there were a number of men suffering from what we would call PTSD today, who went looking for peace, a peace that they couldn't find anywhere else, and that they hoped they would find, you know, in the contemplative life of a monastery. But it doesn't work that way. You know, that's not how you find peace. Turning away from the world won't necessarily bring you that peace. Sometimes you have to find that peace in lots of other different ways.
What is the calling? It's not just to disconnect from the world, but to draw yourself inward?
It's a calling to relate to God in a way that most of us are not called to relate to God. To relate to God from the perspective of a contemplative lifestyle rather than a lifestyle that's in active ministry in the world.
Michael Higgins, I have to say, it seems like drawing yourself away and not being engaged with the needy of the world, it doesn't seem like an act of Christian service on some level. What am I not understanding about that?
But I think the monastic calling has always been a puzzle or a paradox or even a scandal for some who look at it as being largely non-productive. But surely that's the point. Surely the point is that the contemplative lifestyle is a lifestyle that's not based on utility. Its purpose is not external to the subject's aspirations toward transcendence and greater interiority. So that the monastic life is really not an option to escape the world or withdraw from the world. It is to move ever closer to a profound encounter with the God who calls you into that life. And it is not without its quite significant challenges and difficulties. I think that, you know, people go into monastic life for several reasons. Some because they've experienced great trauma in their life. I think that was true of a number of people who experienced the war. Or an existential malaise. They've lost all sense of meaning and purpose. And the monastic life, or the regulated life, offers them an opportunity to establish some identity and continuity and surety in a world in perpetual flux. Others have gone through perhaps some crisis in terms of their sexual lives, in terms of their professional lives, and are looking for the kind of order and rhythm that the regulated or monastic life can provide. So there are numerous reasons why people enter into a monastery. And I think if you look at some of the great monks of our time, you'll find that they constantly subject to examination their motives as to why they entered into monastic life. So there's never the kind of definitive end that people sometimes think that draws you into the monastic cycle. Well, I've made my decision. I'm now solemnly professed. I'm a monk forever. Everything is over. Not so. And monastic life actually grows both in terms of its perplexity, but also in its fruits as one matures in the years as a monk.
I think you could say that there is a service element, though, even in the contemplative lifestyle. And that is when, you know, I read the devotional works of a lot of writers in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, and they emphasize, and especially the women, emphasize that they believe their prayers are saving the world. So this is the ultimate service, you could say, that even though it's not necessarily in the form of what some orders do, of hospital work or education or something like this, it's still, they still see it that way, that they really, their prayers, without their prayers, the world would be destroyed, you know, by the anger of God because of all the sins of people and so on. So I think that did have an element. And not only that, but if you study the actual practice of monasteries, you know, which I think I've come at it more as a social historian, you see that even the contemplative monasteries play a big role in the world right around them. People are coming to the grill where they can talk to the nuns. They have economic exchange with some of them because they're making products for the world. They depend on the gifts of those outsiders and so on. So to me, there is a real connection even in the most contemplative monasteries.
What is the difference, Margaret McGinnis, between a monk and a nun? How is the experience different for women, just on its most – we'll dig into this, but on its most basic level? I mean, beyond the obvious?
Well, it depends on which community you're a member of. And so it's not necessarily the difference between a monk and a nun, but the difference between, you know, do you follow the rule of Benedict, or do you follow the Poor Clare, which would be a Franciscan model, or do you follow a Carmelite? And so, and that would have to do with how you look to the heritage of your congregation and how your life is structured based on those rules.
It's interesting you've written about the particular challenges for women. It's certainly earlier, the restrictions on women. For many years, if you were a woman, you couldn't just go off and live in the world as a single woman.
Right.
If you weren't connected to a church or some sort of order, I mean, it just wouldn't be, I guess it wouldn't be proper.
Right. And in fact, in this country, when contemplative nuns first began to come to this country, American bishops didn't want them because they wanted women religious who would work. They wanted teachers and they wanted nurses and they wanted women who would open orphanages and homes for the elderly and so on. And they honestly thought that women who were cloistered or contemplative were going to be a drain on their financial resources, that they would have to take care of these women, or that these women would be trying to raise money from the very people that they were hoping would build schools and hospitals. And they were often not welcome in certain dioceses in this country.
That's really ironic, because in the medieval and early modern period, contemplative nuns were the most desired form of convent life. And the active orders, they kept popping up everywhere, you know, hospitals, schooling, and they kept being suppressed. And they kept insisting that the only legitimate form of monastic life for women is the cloistered life, the contemplative life. And yet there were bishops who insisted on that, but also bishops who supported the more active orders. But somehow the active orders were always seen as second-rate citizens, so I find that really interesting that when, by the time, you know, this was coming over to the U.S., it was the other way around.
Yes, and actually they're still technically kind of considered second-class citizens in terms of women religious. You know, perpetual vows versus simple vows and so on and so forth. And in terms of sort of the canonical structure, cloistered nuns have always kind of been seen as somehow more nuns than active women religious.
Women who wanted to take on a more kind of apostolic lifestyle, was it a form of expressing themselves, a form of feminism, Craig Harling? Is that fair to say?
You could say that. I mean, maybe even more of an expression of that would be the Beguines, or in the Rhine Valley, which is now northern France, western Germany, the Low Countries. These were women who did not necessarily follow a rule, and they did not consider themselves female religious, but they wanted to live a kind of pious life in their own community, and yet they were free to leave that community. They could own property and so on. And to me, that always...
Did they have habits? And
yeah, they did, but they owned their own houses. And huh. And real female religious couldn't own property, right? But here they owned their own houses. They pretty much dictated how things would go in their community. So it's this community, 300 women sometimes, 400 women. They didn't want to marry necessarily. Some of them left to marry, but many of them didn't want to marry. But they didn't want to live that full-blown lifestyle. So yeah, I would definitely say that there were the various forms of female religious life were an expression not only of devotion, but of their particular restrictions on them as women.
And they had beautiful communities. And I've seen some pictures of them. It was very ordered and kind of lovely.
Yeah. No, and especially in the Beguinages, those disappeared in the in the 1960s and 70s. I mean, I when I first started traveling to Europe to do research, that there were two Beguines left in the city of Leuven, I think. But the social function of that had disappeared because there were so many more opportunities for women in the 20th century that they didn't feel the need to go into that particular kind of community.
There's a marvelous, and it's not much of an historical aberration, but it is an interesting story of a convent, I think in Nuremberg, in Germany, during the height of the Reformation, when efforts were made, I think it was Philip Melanchthon, in fact, were made to free the nuns from the convent, as indeed in the full flourish of Lutheranism, there was a backlash against all forms of monastic life. And the mother prioress of the community of nuns resisted that, and as did all the nuns who were in the convent, because the convent gave them an order and freedom that even the reformers couldn't offer, because the reformers were offering them marriage. And for many of them, marriage was not the route they wanted to go. So their life in the convent, in spite of the reform, provided them with an alternate life and witness that perdured, at least for the history of that convent. But by and large, they maintained their independence, and of course with people like Hildegard of Bingen much earlier in the millennium, second millennium, you have remarkable examples of such strong women that even bishops quaked in their presence.
I wonder, women religious, do they follow the same arc that we're seeing in men leading or not leading monastic lives? That is a decline right now. Are we seeing a decline in interest by women religious and these orders and interest in it, those sorts of things?
Absolutely. The numbers are significantly lower. The peak year for women religious in the United States was 1964, about 180,000. And I think we're down to something like 60,000 now, and the average age is in the 70s. So it's a combination of women who left religious life in the 1960s and 70s, coupled with the fact that women weren't joining religious congregations in that time. And since then, if you look even on social media at the Facebook sites that congregations have, they'll talk about welcoming their two new novices, where 50 years ago there might have been 40 new novices in a class. So there's very much a decline and very much an aging population.
Does part of that, I think, for women, does it have to do with the fact that single women can properly now go out into society and live their own lives alone and create their own kinds of communities? They don't need a religious order. They don't need to connect to some institution to have a life like that.
That is absolutely part of it. And when you read the accounts of women who left religious life in the 60s and 70s, although some of them left because they had met someone and wanted to get married or whatever, a lot of them say, I didn't need to be a sister or a woman religious in order to do what I wanted to do, to be a social worker, to be a lawyer, to be a school principal or whatever. I could do that without the structure of a congregation. And so women didn't see it as so freeing anymore by the 1970s.
You know, and another thing in relation to that, in deeply homogeneous or hegemonic Catholic cultures like Poland or Ireland, for instance, or in Canada, in the province of Quebec, you not only had very large families, but it was expected that within those families, people would give, right up to fairly recent times, would give one of their children to the church.
Yeah.
Now, it could be to the clergy, or it could be to religious life as women. And so it was not uncommon at all that in a family of 12, 14, 16 children, that there would be one or two nuns or one or two priests or whatever. These large families, of course, don't exist anymore. And these cultures are no longer homogeneously Catholic. And there are other faith traditions now emerging in these traditionally Catholic jurisdictions. And as a result, there are a number of social and economic factors that come into play, not just theological, which contribute to making the call to religious life for a woman more challenging. One has to be really quite intentional about this, because you do have so many other alternatives and options that are there for you that are legitimate social and ecclesial options. So if you're going to be drawn to religious life, and some are, their numbers are small, but there are, it has to be really the result of a very clear and intentional effort to live that life, in contradistinction to the other options, which you could easily exercise by virtue of your education, your upbringing, and your status.
Yeah. It seems like that, I guess that is, that's the case for both men and women, that you can go off to and travel the world now as a solitary figure. You can go hitchhiking through Europe, have your own kind of contemplative experience there. I mean, you see it with young people often taking those gap years and just going off to be by themselves or experience the world in a different way. You can go to a yoga retreat, you know, and have a similar kind of contemplative sort of experience. It seems like there's so many options now that you don't need to find a monastery or some sort of cloistered religious existence for it.
I mean, to add to what Michael said, not only are there a lot more options, but there is a lot less parental encouragement to enter religious life. Parents don't say anymore, oh, that's wonderful, my daughter's going to be a sister or my son's going to be a monk or a priest. They say, why are you going to do that? I thought you were going to go to law school.
Yeah.
You know, I would rather that you backpacked through Europe by yourself.
You can find that in the earlier period as well. Of course, there are famous instances of even Claire herself went into the religious life against the wishes of her family. But I was going to comment on the other side of it. In addition to the draw of the monastic life that we've been talking about, there was also a push in the past. There's a great study of 17th century French religious women. And I don't know how she came up with the figure, but I found it really provocative. And she suggests that up to a third of them probably didn't enter because they wanted to. In other words, they entered out of family interest. So sometimes there's also the push that, you know, this is what is acceptable for women, and so you're going to go into that. I mean, individual women who might have felt the pull, it was because, oh, I see here an outlet for myself. But then there's also the push that you have to go into this life. And this results in a lot of women not necessarily having a vocation. And so there were problems in the past in that regard as well.
That's Craig Harleen, who teaches history at Brigham Young University. Michael Higgins is a professor of Catholic thought at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And Margaret McGinnis is a professor of religion at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. Earlier this year, the Trappist Monastery in Huntsville, Utah, closed after 70 years. We've created a short film about it. You can see it at radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of the monastic life. And you really cannot talk about this story without saying something about Thomas Merton. Merton was a theologian, a mystic, a monk, who wrote a best-selling autobiography called The Seven-Story Mountain. Merton comes up in the conversation today because he and others influenced this surge of people to lead monastic lives after World War II. Throughout the program, we heard from Margaret McGinnis, a professor of religion at LaSalle University in Philadelphia, from Craig Harleen, who teaches history at Brigham Young University, and from Michael Higgins, a professor of Catholic thought at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Let's talk about Thomas Merton. Michael Higgins, let me shift to you on this point to get us started. You say that for many people, Merton was a sectarian figure. This is how you describe it, an icon, you say, that we honor rather than think of as an enduring prod to our spiritual or intellectual complacency. I wanted to have you kind of unpack that for me. So basically, we don't really, when we think about Merton, we think about Merton the icon, and we maybe don't get him fully. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think we have a romanticized view of Merton in many ways, in the same sense that Merton himself had a romanticized view of the monastic life. Merton's experience of monasticism was far less placid than people think, and far more turbulent than perhaps we would want to think. But that didn't make him an unsuccessful, quotation marks around unsuccessful, monk. In fact, it made him, I think, a very relevant monk. I think the danger comes when we see him as uniquely Catholic property, or we see him as the paradigmatic monk for anyone in the world who wants to pursue monastic life, either in a temporary mode, as is often the case with Buddhism, or in its more permanent mode, as is the more traditional classic Christian model. I think that Merton's spiritual questing is what appeals to large numbers, and the fact that he took his contemplative insights and made them available not only for lay people, for people who weren't taking vows and to live in institutionally monastic or religious structures, but were looking for the benefit of contemplative life and meditation in their ordinary lives. And by the fact that he took the wisdom of the great monastic traditions and made them available through several of his writings for the layperson. And in addition to that, what I think he did was open up through his very rich dialogue, his interfaith dialogue, with Buddhism and with Hinduism most particularly, but with the other traditions as well. He opened up conversations that allowed their particular monastic iterations to come to fruition in dialogue with the Christian model. So Merton, if we think of him in a sectarian way, we delimit him, we restrict him. And I see him, in a sense, as a extraterritorial figure, both spiritually and intellectually, and that allows him to have quite the compelling and, I think, enduring influence that he has even now, which will be, in 2018, 50 years since his death.
Yeah. Rooted to Christian dogma, but you say that gave him a freedom to explore the other elements, but he was still rooted there, I suppose.
Oh, he's very much a Christian monk. In many ways, Merton was a conservative Catholic intellectual. I think sometimes we tend to think of him as simply some radical fringe figure. I think in many ways he was a foundational figure and a conservative one, in the best sense of conservative, of course, not in a strident or militant sense, but someone who was rooted in a specific tradition. But he wasn't restricted to that. And it was because he wasn't restricted to that that he could be admired for his tremendous openness.
It's his, we need to talk about his book, Seven Story Mountain, which I know he felt conflicted about. He was only 31 when that book came out, and I guess it was 1948. And he became a kind of, as I think Michael Higgins, as you've put it, he started to bear the stamp of a celebrity monk, and that was impossible for him to erase, that he became a kind of child of this sort of success. But he had a difficulty with that book because it had become a myth, and it was something that he, I guess, as he grew older, began to move past. Say something about that, if you would, Michael Higgins.
Well, there are problems. I mean, who writes their autobiography at that age, right?
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, he was ordered to write the autobiography by his then abbot. So the problem with the success of the Seven Story Mountain is layered in that it established for him a celebrity status as the go-to monk, and he became an inspiration for many people who entered monastic life, either as women or as men, but particularly men, who saw him as a model. And as a consequence, their own vocation was destroyed on the shoals of that identification. I remember talking to John Utz Bamberger, who was a scholastic or novice under Merton. And I asked him once what kind of a monk Merton was. He said, well, Michael, he was a very good, and then he paused, Merton monk. So he was his own kind of monk. And other younger monks who wanted to emulate him were finding it very difficult. Merton spends the rest of his life, really, writing The Seven Story Mountain. He has to, because, of course, when the autobiography comes out, he's still a very young man. And his views of the world, his poetry, for instance, he's a significant religious poet, plus his essays, plus his other books that he's writing, his sense of himself as a monk, all of these things are going to change. And there's going to be a healthy dynamic of change. So what does he do? So he spends the rest of his life writing journals and diaries, which is nothing more, really, than the continuation of the Seven Story Mountain during the remaining decades of his life. So the success of the Seven Story Mountain was a great chain around his neck. And at the time that he wrote the preface to the Japanese edition of the Seven Story Mountain, he made it very clear that he deplored the myth of the Seven Story Mountain man, which he had become.
You mentioned that preface to the Japanese edition of the book. This was in 1963. And he said that when he had first written it, the fact uppermost in his mind was that he had seceded from the world. But since that time, he started to think differently of it, that he learned to, as he put it, look back into that world with greater compassion. Mm-hmm. That seems like an interesting transition. At first, he thought of himself disconnecting from the world, and in the time since, he thought about it differently, that it wasn't seceding from the world. It was something different.
Well, he talks about the particular epiphany he has in the 1950s in Louisville and 4th and Walnut, when he comes to understand in a very powerful illumination that he actually loves the people who are walking by him. That moment is often seen as not only an epiphanic moment or a transformative moment, but as a clear instance of Merton's shift from a kind of traditional, if not literal, contemptus mundi or hatred for the world to its actual embrace of the world, or more particularly the inhabitants of the world. And so by the mid-1950s, certainly by 1956, you begin to see a significant shift in Merton's attitude toward the very early motivation that propelled him to enter monastic life in the first place in December of 1941.
Craig Harley and Margaret McGinnis, let me get you involved in this part of the conversation. What is your sense, and Craig Harley, we'll start with you, how influential was that in men streaming into monasteries in those years after the war?
Oh, my sense is that it came a lot from the Seven Story Mountain. I also wonder, you know, going back to that question of why is monasticism on the decline or whatever, did Merton have something to do with that in the sense of what Michael was just saying? In other words, that he kind of shifted the consciousness, if you want to put it that way, that the religious life could happen outside of the monastery. Now, people have been saying this for a long time, but nevertheless, he gave it maybe a new authority, or maybe he's tapping into what, you know, Jung would call the collective unconscious, right, that it's shifting itself. And maybe that helps to explain some of that. But the Seven Story Mountain must have driven a lot of people into the monastery. Now, it was happening in Europe in the 50s as well, but even in the 50s, I was studying this past summer, they were beginning to realize there was going to be a crisis in vocations. It happened, in other words, before the 60s. Mm-hmm. And part of it was the disillusionment from the war. So on the one hand, some were going in because of the war, but on the other hand, even after they were there, there was still this great disillusionment from what had happened with the war, with all the killing and so on. It wasn't supposed to go that way in life. So in the European side, maybe there wasn't the Seven Story Mountain driving them in, but there are these other forces working as well.
Margaret, what do you think?
Well, I really liked what Michael said about that Merton was a great Merton monk. I mean, not many monks are hanging out with Joan Baez, you know, in the 1960s the way Merton is. And I do think, I mean, Gethsemane, the abbey where he was, certainly builds, you know, kind of new accommodations for all these men who are heading there. And it's hard to know exactly why they go and exactly why they leave, although, as Craig pointed out, there is by the 50s kind of a sense that something's going on. But just, you know, one thing I would add is whenever I teach Merton, there is always a student who goes out and buys the Seven Story Mountain and reads it. You know, there's always one who's just, who Merton just, you know, even in kind of a 50-minute class, you know, really, really connects with him somehow. They don't necessarily trek to Gethsemane to enter the congregation, but they're drawn to him, you know, and to what he has to say, even at the ripe old age of 31.
Right. And doesn't that say then that there is still the potential for an appeal for, if not a conventional monastic life, a more contemplative life among the millennials or the people that you teach, Margaret McGinnis?
You know, absolutely. And there are, you know, there are some really interesting new ways of looking at religious life out there that we don't, you know, we haven't really had a chance to kind of see how they kind of will shape religious life. But for instance, there's a congregation in Vermont called the Green Sisters, inspired by Thomas Berry and environmentalism, you know, and looking at kind of not so much sort of a semi-contemplative lifestyle, but turning away from Fox News and CNN and, you know, looking kind of at into deeper ways of learning and knowing. And there are young men and women who are still interested in it. There are less of them, and it's not clear why they're interested, and it's not clear why they are drawn to the communities that they are drawn to. And I don't want to call it a resurgence, because it isn't. But it's not gone yet.
That's Margaret McGinnis. She's a professor of religion at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. Michael Higgins is a professor of Catholic thought at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And Craig Harleen teaches history at Brigham Young University. Let me point out that earlier this year, the Trappist Monastery in Huntsville, Utah, closed after 70 years, and we have created a short film with the last of the monks as they reflected on what it means to close a monastery. You can see it at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
On the next More to Say...
How's the food?
Oh my gosh, so good. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, okay, so I didn't eat the burgers.
There's a cafe in Draper where you can order a prison blues burger, the cellmate BLT, or the steakout breakfast bagel. It's called Serving Time Cafe, and it's run by female inmates from the state prison.
They don't care how fat they're going to make you, so they make them really good.
The next episode of More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're remembering the monastery in Huntsville, Utah, which closed this past summer after 70 years. It was a community of monks that flourished there for decades, but after a while, they stopped coming. The show today really is about the monastic life, why people withdraw from the world to live lives of contemplation and work. We had with us Margaret McGinnis, a professor of religion at LaSalle University in Philadelphia, Michael Higgins, a professor of Catholic thought at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut, and Craig Harleen. He teaches history at Brigham Young University. Craig Harleen, is there a modern version of a monastery, you know, one disconnected from literal faith or organized religion, maybe people driven by the impersonal nature of the digital age, for
example. Margaret was just mentioning a couple. What particular forms would they take? You think about all the new interest, for the last 40, 50 years in meditation, and especially under the influence of Eastern religions. I think we often have the impression that, you know, all the great meditation traditions come from the East, and neglecting that, yeah, that exists in Christianity as well. But somehow it has a more novel effect, and maybe that helps to explain some of the popularity that, oh, this is something new. It's in a slightly different form. It's something that we're interested in. And maybe, you know, in a cultural sort of way, you have that Christian background, that meditative background, but you only recognize it as something fresh and something interesting if you see it in another form, perhaps.
Michael Higgins, you've talked about how there are some of these orders, and I guess there are not a lot of them, but I think you mentioned the Christ in the Desert just outside of Santa Fe as a place that is I think you described it as bulging at the seams. There are plenty of people
It is
there.
Bulging at the seams. It's extraordinary. Now, I'd say it's a monastery, again, outside of Santa Fe in Ibiquiu, Christ in the Desert. Merton actually visited the monastery in the remaining months of his life, 1968. I was invited to come to the monastery for the 100th anniversary of Merton's birth. So that would have been 2015, to speak to the chapter, to all the monks that were there. And I had done a similar thing for a monastery of the same Subiaco Cassanese Benedictine tradition in northern New York in Elmira, Mount Savior University. And the numbers were what one would expect now, many senior monks, a few middle-aged, and their numbers quite small. Well, I went to the New Mexico one, and it just blew me out of the room. The monastery, and even now, I've just received their newsletter. They have, 16 novices and almost as many postulants, and they're in a massive building campaign because they have to accommodate an additional 40 monks. Wow. They're sending them out to some of their foundations, particularly in Mexico and elsewhere. And I spent a while with them, and I was struck by many things. I was struck by their scintillating conversation. They were sharply intelligent young monks. Many of them had just been recent graduates of universities, and not necessarily in departments of religious studies or theology by any stretch of the mind. There was a former attorney general of the state. There was a professor who had given up his tenure at Notre Dame to teach the monks. He was a Benedictine himself, but he wanted to specifically live within this monastic environment. And I found them not only not overly romantic or naive, but really quite measured and disciplined and joyous. And I mean, I wasn't there long enough to be able to figure out all the reasons for this astounding success, which is completely outside the norm. But it does seem to me that their abbot was a major contributing factor to this, a jolly fellow who had a tremendous sense of the right balance of celebration and reflection and solemnity and decorum and informality. I mean, it all seemed to work masterfully. And I left to come back really very impressed by what I experienced. And it wasn't necessarily the numbers per se, although the numbers clearly were striking. It was the quality of those numbers, the individual men. I had the opportunity to speak to several of them, both individually and collectively. And I don't know whether it's I would agree with Maggie. I don't think it's a mark of a resurgence. I don't think there is a resurgence of the traditional model. But I do think it's a confirmation that for some, that traditional model, deeply humanized, flexible, resilient, open, can work. And it can work wonderfully well if you've got all the aspects together. You've got the alchemy. Fits right, and they do seem to have the alchemy fitting right in this place in New Mexico. Because I've been to many abbeys in Quar and Prittage and all around in Scotland and Ireland and England, Canada, and the States, and this one is unlike any of the others. And even its mother foundation, Mount Savior in Elmira, New York, can't hold a candle to it in terms of its vitality. I've also seen some of the new ecclesial communities that flourished under the pontificate of John Paul II. Some of them cloistered, many of them very traditional, some of them longing for the restitution of the habit. And again, the motivations are many, the historical factors myriad, so it's not easy to reduce it to one cause alone. Some of them, I think, are quite evanescent. It's just a yearning for a secure identity in a time of considerable change. For some, however, it will be more than that. Mm. And it perhaps during this time of significant flux, we need to hold our judgment in order to see judge these religious openings, if you like, by their fruit. I think many of them will wither on the vine, if you like, because they will be if not obscurantist in their theology, certainly they will be restorationist in their sensibility, and that historically simply won't work. But others, however, there will be an essentially liberating charism at the core of what they're doing. We'll just take time to test it. I don't know what the recipe is for the Monastery of Christ the King in New Mexico, but it worked. And if they can package it and sell it, I'm sure there will be many abbots who would be happy to purchase it.
Craig, Harlene, do you think that in some ways this is going on in conventional religion in general? People who are choosing... picking and choosing the doctrine that they that is appealing to them, choosing to stay with. I'm thinking of the Mormon community here. I mean, it's very typical here where people are, they have a more expansive sense of what Mormonism might be. They're not entirely connecting to the Orthodox part of Mormonism, but they like the ritual, they like the community, they like the family part of it. So the picking and choosing parts. And choosing to stay. I'm wondering if this is kind of a trend.
Well, it's possible. I think when you study the long run of religious life, people are always picking and choosing. We like to say, oh, you can't be a cafeteria Catholic or Mormon or whatever.
But they always are.
Everybody is. Right? And when have you not done that? And so I think the ones that are going, the religious forms that will survive are those that somehow connect people to modern trends, to modern needs, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, and so on. And I think that when Michael talks about this community in New Mexico, I wonder if that isn't the case, that they've tapped into that. So in the past, entry into monasteries went up and down as well. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this many people say this is more severe than that. It's more fundamental than that. But then it makes me also think, if that's true, maybe there's a shift into new forms. And so whether, whatever religion might be involved, you hang on because there's some new need or that's fulfilled through some new form, and I think that's exactly how they will survive.
Margaret, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I would agree with Craig, and I think that one thing we're seeing is a change in the shape and nature of organized religion in general, especially in what we used to call mainline Protestantism. In Catholicism, in Judaism, the buzzword on college campuses today is, I'm not very religious, but I'm spiritual.
Yeah.
and I know what that means. I'm not sure everybody who says it knows what it means for them. But there's clearly a shift, and there's clearly the way millennials look at organized religion is clearly very different from the way folks have looked at religion, at least in, say, the last 50 or 60 years. And we'll see what that brings, They're clearly looking for something, but you mentioned, I think, Craig, cafeteria Catholics or cafeteria Mormons. They don't see anything wrong with that. They know what they're seeking, and they're going to seek it until they find it.
I think also, Craig is right about the cafeteria cat. We've always been this way. It's just we've been more subtle and nuanced in the past, because any significant departure would result in some sort of censure or social sanction. Mm-hmm. Now those don't exist, and so people choose and pick with relative impunity. But I think we've always chosen what in a tradition particularly appeals to us, what makes sense, what we see as retrograde or deadening of the spirit. I think we've been doing that since time immemorial.
Mm-hmm. That's what all the new religious orders, that's what I said earlier. I think every new religious order was some kind of choice. This is the things that I want to, these are the things I want to emphasize. And I think that will be the case with new religious movements or new
they're
religious
orders. They're acts of reform in some way.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
You know what I'm going to miss, though, is the honey and the candles. I feel like that it's that the product of their work, of their considered ability, is the thing I find almost more sad than anything else. Is the idea of working and. Maybe that won't go away, but I really am going to miss that part of it.
It's different than just going to a honey factory or something.
No,
right?
It absolutely is different.
There are monasteries like Saint-Pierre-de-Solem in France and Saint-Benoît-du-Lac in Quebec that are really committed to the preservation of the Salem tradition in Gregorian chant. And so these are aesthetic treasures for the European patrimony, if you like. I mean, this is part of a great tradition that needs to be preserved. And so there are specific monastic communities that have a history of that is centuries old and that embody particular aspects, again, largely of the European or Eurocentric dimension of Christianity, but nonetheless essential to that growth, that I think we need to preserve. And there's a lot of evidence that is still the case, and we have reason to be optimistic about that. The other ones, you're talking about the honey, and of course there's the bread, which is a big thing, but my experience with Gethsemane was the bourbon-laced fruit, which you know was a bestseller, and I remember on one occasion going there, I think in the early 1970s, 71 or 72, so it's just a few years after Merton had died, and I was wandering in the lakes, or five lakes, on the grounds of the Abbey of Gethsemane. It was a huge agriculture operation in the state of Kentucky. And before I went, I had been eating this fruitcake, and during those days, they really maintained a fairly rigorous regimen for the lay visitors and retreatants as well as for the monks. And so I ate more of the fruitcake than I should have, and so I went off into the woods, and a goose chased me, and because I guess I was close to the goslings or something, so I had to go over this fence, which made me very uneasy. And when I got back, Merton's secretary, Brother Patrick Hart, said to me, "Michael, you look ashen. What have you been doing?" I said, "Well, a goose chased me, and I had to climb over the fence to join the cows." And he said, "How much of that fruitcake did you eat?" And I said, "Oh, quite a few." He says, "Well, you're intoxicated because the fence you climbed over was electrified. That's why you weren't feeling very good. And the reason why you're wobbly right now is that you overindulged in the fruitcake." So I've got this lingering memory of bourbon-laced fruitcake that's never left my consciousness for the last four decades, but They're now, the fruitcake, I think, has gone into, they're just working on the fudge now.
Yeah.
But the Trappists in Spencer Mass are brewing beer.
Yes, they are. In the tradition of the Belgians, yeah.
Oh, so we'll still have plenty to eat and drink from
absolutely.
The monastic life. Well, that's good.
That's right.
That's Michael Higgins. He's a professor of Catholic thought at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Margaret McGinnis is a professor of religion at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. And Craig Harling joined us in studio. He teaches history at Brigham Young University. And one final reminder about the short film we created of the last monks at the Trappist Monastery in Huntsville, Utah. You can see the film at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Aaron McGregor in Philadelphia and to Anthony Scoma. We had technical direction from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.